Will Brexit really allow the UK government to take back control of its trade policy? And what are the trade-offs it's going to have to make along the way? Welcome to Vox Talks, a series of interviews with leading economists around the world. My name is Tim Phillips, and as you can hear, I'm at the University of Sussex for the 2018 Royal Economic Society Annual Conference. A packed panel discussion on the trade implications of Brexit's just finished, and soon the panellists are going to be heading off into nearby Brighton for a public meeting about the same topic. But first, I'm going to catch up with one of the experts who's just been speaking. Alan Winters is a professor of economics at the University of Sussex, and he's also the director of the UK Trade Policy Observatory. I'm going to ask him about what goes into a modern trade agreement and why they're harder to negotiate than we assume. Brexit's clearly a subject that has many dimensions for economists, but today we want to talk about trade and specifically free trade agreements before and after Brexit. So what do we mean when we talk about the UK's free trade agreements at the moment?
Well, at the moment, the UK is a member of free trade agreements because as a member of the European Union, it's a member of the free trade agreements the European Union has signed. And there are 30-some of those covering nearly 70 countries. And they range from very small countries to much larger ones. But about 13, 14% of British exports go to countries which have free trade agreements with the European Union.
And to be clear, which a lot of people have found out in the last year or two, the UK doesn't have its own free trade agreements.
No, that's right. Part of the deal of being in the customs union of the European Union is that we're committed to have exactly the same trade policy as every other member, and therefore that's basically run for us from the centre by the European Commission.
So let's imagine going forward that the UK has not negotiated replacement free trade agreements at the time that the current EU agreements lapse, whenever that is. How will that affect the UK economy?
Well, as I said, it produces some benefits and they frankly will disappear. And also, of course, it will be very disruptive in the sense that suddenly trades that were taking place at very low tariffs will face quite high tariffs. One of the features of the set of countries the EU has signed up with is that a number of them have quite high tariff rates. But of course, one must also remember that the UK is seeking a free trade agreement with the European Union. And in addition, the European Union is negotiating free trade agreements with a lot of other countries, including rather more important ones economically. For instance, the United States, we haven't formally closed negotiations for TTIP, India. And so these are economies which might matter in the end even more. And of course, if we're on the outside, we won't get any of that benefit.
Yet we also hear a narrative that if we don't have free trade agreements, it will be an overnight disaster for the economy. Is that overstating things?
I would worry much more about trade with the European Union and the disruption of that than I would the loss of these free trade agreements. But it would be material. It would be material for, that set of companies that have set themselves up to trade intensively with those partners. That trade will be disrupted. The companies will be disrupted.
What should the UK government be targeting when it comes to free trade in the future?
The really critical thing that we've got to determine is what's our relationship with the rest of Europe. If we have a very close relationship, it might be so close, in fact, that we stay in a customs union and we don't have an independent trade policy. It might be, on the other hand, that we are very distant from Europe, trading under what people refer to as WTO rules. And under those circumstances, I think my advice would be to proceed cautiously with trying to negotiate free trade agreements with other countries. As I did say this morning, a simple free trade agreement gives you tariff-free access to one another's markets. Tariffs are taxes on imports, and tariff preferences, which reduce those to zero, are just tax breaks for your friends. And if you think about them as being tax breaks for your friends, you at least ask the question, is that a good thing? So I think if we are right on the outside of Europe, we ought certainly to pursue a very multilateral policy. I wouldn't rule out free trade agreements, but I wouldn't desperately rush off and try and sign them up, willy-nilly straight away.
If we give a series of bilateral tax breaks to our friends, what's the danger of that?
The danger with a tax break is that the person who gets the tax break starts to capture markets in your country when they're not the most efficient supplier. Imagine that everybody faces the same tariff. You have to pay the tariff on any import, so you buy it from the cheapest source. But now, supposing one source doesn't have to pay the tariff, he might actually be more expensive, but because he doesn't pay the tariff, you go to him instead. But of course, the government isn't picking up the tariff revenue. So as a country, you've ended up paying more for your imports than you might otherwise. We call that trade diversion.
A lot of people talk about trade agreements, and we've done this so far, as if they are only about these tariffs. That's not all there is to it, and that's not what the majority of them are, the really effective trade agreements are at the moment.
Yes, that's right. Simple, plain, vanilla trade agreements of the tariff sort now are rather out of fashion. Some still exist. Essentially, we need to think, what are the things that you can add to it? There are a number of things, for instance, regulations that you can harmonise, or at least mutually recognise regulations, so that you can more easily trade goods free of concerns about standards. That's very important for services, for instance. You can agree regulatory cooperation. We ask you, we inform you if we want to change a regulation, and you tell us, oh, that's horrible, or it's fine by us. You might also have agreements on customs cooperation to try and smooth the flow of trade. If there's no tariff being charged, it's an awful shame to have to stop the lorry or stop the ship, you know, just to check other things. And so maybe you can create a more favourable environment there. I think the important thing about all these sort of add-ons, which we often refer to as deep integration, is that in a free trade agreement between two countries, say the UK and another country, the depth issues, the deep issues, are not nearly as deep as they are within the European Union. The European Union has gone further than any other collection of countries in harmonising standards, recognising standards, managing services trade. And so a deep trade agreement is probably better than a non-deep trade agreement, but it's not like the single market.
And this is when people start talking about global supply chains, European supply chains. These have been built up based on that deep integration, haven't they?
More often than not, yes. And particularly within Europe, where integration is so deep that selling a good, say, from Sussex to Paris is more or less the same as selling it from Sussex to Surrey or Yorkshire. Basically no paperwork, basically no delays on the border. You pay your VAT, but you pay your VAT on an internal transaction. So in a sense, the single market really has created something that looks, to all intents and purposes, for these goods industries, like a single domestic market. Nothing else has got remotely that far down the road.
What's the problem with our trade negotiators replacing the deep integration that we've had as part of the EU with deep integration in our bilateral free trade agreements?
It's a complicated business, as the European Union shows. It requires a great deal of oversight and possibly a supranational court to make sure things happen. And so it impinges on your sovereignty. And Brexit is said to be about taking back control and reclaiming sovereignty. Well, the last thing you would want to do is reclaim your sovereignty, only then to give it away to somebody else. Now, even setting that aside, regulations are deep-held cultural and historical phenomena. They have a history. It's always a very interesting history. And so when two countries come together to sort of bring their regulations into alignment, each is giving up something, stuff that they hold dear. They've got regulatory authorities who are a bit jealous of their rights to manage a sector. So that it's a very, very complicated and politically intrusive process. Final thing, we've got to do it not just with the European Union, as it were, talking to the European Commission, but with 163 other countries that are members of WTO. It's not only that that's hard work doing all of those negotiations, but often they will have regulations that are not compatible. So if you decide to harmonise your regulation with, say, the USA, and you accept chlorine-washed chicken, you cannot then harmonise the same regulation with Europe, which doesn't accept chlorine washed chicken. So there are sort of constraints, there are immense practical problems, and the politics are very intrusive.
One route through that has been suggested is the idea that we just roll over our European Union free trade agreements to a search and replace, if you like, take out Europe and put in the UK.
Yes.
Is that not possible?
It's probably not. The European Union and the UK agreed in the transition agreement that the European Union would write to these countries with which it has free trade agreements and say, treat our mate Britain as if it never left, for the transition. It's not clear that those countries are obliged to do so. We will have to see. But even if they agree to do that for a transition, going forward, there are a number of issues. First is so-called rules of origin. If one country offers another a trade preference, I offer you a trade preference for your good, I've got to know that it's your good. It's not something you've imported cheaply from China and are just sending on to me. It's a so-called rule of origin. Typically, they require that half the value of the good has been created in your country. Now, there are a lot of goods which Britain exports to these free trade agreement partners where half the value isn't British, half of it is European, but suddenly that won't count. There's also a danger that some of these free trade agreements refer back to European law. So, for instance, the agreement with Korea has a little clause, quite adventurous clause, on financial services. The Koreans agree to accept any financial service that is all right by European law. But that doesn't say British law. And while we might possibly persuade them to accept British law, we've got to go and talk about it. And when you turn up knocking on the door and ask, we want to change this rule, we want the rule of origin changed, the answer is yes, and what do we get in return? So it immediately becomes a quite serious negotiation. And there are 30-some of them, and there are 70 countries involved.
You've been an expert on trade for many years now. These sort of debates are being had in public, really for the first time since Brexit in the UK. Is this something that was always widely known, but only amongst experts on trade?
No, I don't think it's true to say that it was widely known. When we joined the common market, as it was, January 1st, 1973, and I'm old enough to remember this and to have even voted when we put it to the referendum shortly afterwards, there was discussion about trade issues. But trade was quite heavily managed by tariffs, a lot of non-tariff barriers, and we got a lot of our imports from the Commonwealth and other countries around the world. There was debate about whether we were stitching up Australian butter producers or New Zealand lamb producers. So it was sort of current. And then we had a period even inside the European Union when we had a lot of non-tariff barriers, voluntary export restraints. We persuaded the Japanese not to do us the disservice by selling us good cars for cheap prices. But by about the middle of the 1980s, late 1980s, in a sense, the world moved on and we became much more fixed on the idea that markets should be used for these things. And so, in a sense, trade policy moved from being about tinkering with tariffs to trying to get these deep integration issues sorted out. So all of that has occurred since we've been in the European Union and the Commission has dealt with it. Yeah, we needed a small office in London to keep an eye on it, but it wasn't a major issue. So in some sense, what we're facing now is new. We never have had to deal with it as a country before.
In today's debate, there were some opinions that there were benefits to taking back control of trade policy that hadn't been widely enough discussed, or perhaps weren't given enough credit, certainly amongst the academic economic community. It sounds like that's not an opinion you agree with.
It's a problem, an issue that I recognise, but I don't think that we've got it very wrong in the European Union. Ultimately, there is a trade-off between sovereignty, I do what I want when I want it, and cooperation. And economists typically like cooperation in these trade things because it gets prices down, costs down, more trade, more innovation, we think more growth and more income. But it comes at the cost of constraining what you can do in domestic policy. Brexit, in a sense, was an uprising against the economist's view that just get rid of all of this stuff, it doesn't matter if we can't fix the rules ourselves when we want them, because it's efficient not to do so. And it was taking back control. The referendum didn't state very explicitly or clearly there is going to be a cost to this, but we are now starting to get our heads around this. So there is a trade-off, and it is not illegitimate to say sovereignty is ultimate, and I am willing to pay some economic costs for it. One of the big complications with getting to the bottom of that is, what's the unit which requires sovereignty? Is it the United Kingdom? Some people think it is. Some of the same people think it's not England and Scotland. And within England, what about East Sussex? What about Lewis, where I live? We have a Lewis pound, but we don't control any of our regulations. Are we surrendering sovereignty? Well, you do so because it would be impossible if Lewis was just an economic island, having to change different currencies, charge tariffs and what have you.
Some of the problem, perhaps, has been that these trade issues are quite difficult to explain, especially to people who do not have a background in economics. Is there a responsibility on the academic community to go out and talk more openly about this? I know tonight you're going to a public meeting to discuss these things. Is this something economists should be doing more of?
Yes, I think so. And indeed, we've created the UK Trade Policy Observatory here in Sussex. One of its objectives is explicitly to do that. It is complicated stuff. And talking to people, in a sense, who know next to nothing about it is quite taxing. I wouldn't accept all the responsibility on the economics profession. In a sense, the world has got to be prepared to listen and maybe even try a little bit. And sort of the way we represent Brexit at the moment is as a sort of political knockabout. You know, is Michael Gove up this week or Anna Soubry or what have you? And it's a great shame that it's become so politicised, so we can't sit down and say most of this is gritty technical stuff where expertise can help, and then the experts will lay out for you exactly the trade-off that you should make. So we have a huge responsibility and we should take it very seriously. But it would be nice if, you know, the press, in a sense, was sometimes a little bit less knockabout, and if the public could be persuaded to sit in a room for an hour and listen to me.
Well, finally, Alan, on that knockabout, last month, Policy Exchange, the think tank, grabbed the headlines by arguing that the UK should unilaterally abolish its tariffs. And that even halving tariffs would boost GDP in the UK by 2.6% a year. Is this an analysis that you agree with? And if not, why not?
OK, so I agree that in the long run, in an ideal economy, one would get rid of tariffs. However, the numbers that Policy Exchange were batting around are grossly exaggerated. No, almost the whole economics profession is agreed that they are exaggerated. One of the reasons they're exaggerated is because they pay no attention to different qualities of goods. They treat a knockoff handbag off the street in Jakarta as being the same as a Gucci handbag that you buy in Regent Street. Once you sort of correct for quality, you recognise there have to be standards to, for public health reasons and so on, the benefit of cutting the tariffs is very small because most of the frictions in trade are elsewhere and are doing something useful. The other thing I would say to it is while it's I think a perfectly sensible policy to talk about for the long run, if it is the case that the UK is going to leave the European Union and wants to go around persuading other countries to open their markets up to our exports, just giving them free access to our market for nothing first off, is not going to be great negotiating skills. In the long run, you know, holding those sort of negotiating tariffs is not a smart policy. But we're on the very cusp of a big, big change. And therefore, to sort of give away a bit of the ammunition first off just doesn't seem smart.
Alan Winters, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This has been a Vox Talk presented by the Centre for Economic Policy Research. For more in the series, visit voxeu.org/vox-talks.